his voice. "Alice?"
There was no answer. Elliot had already faded back out into the hall. He didn't seem to have much patience for Alice lately, as somebody who didn't share his rigorous dedication to pleasure-seeking. Quentin supposed her unfussy diligence reminded him unpleasantly of the future he was ignoring. Quentin knew it had that effect on him. He hesitated on the threshold, torn between conflicting loyalties. She would probably be grateful for some quiet time to study. "I think she's coming later," Quentin said. He called in the direction of the bedroom. "Okay. Bye. I'll see you there." There was no answer. "Bye, Mom," Elliot yelled. The door closed. Like everything else, Elliot was different in New York. At Brakebill's, he had always been supremely aloof and self-sufficient. His personal charm and odd appearance and talent for magic had raised him up and set him apart. But since Quentin had joined him in Manhattan, the balance of power between them had shifted somehow. Elliot hadn't survived transplantation unscathed. He no longer floated easily above the fray. His humor was more arch and bitter and childish than Quentin remembered. He seemed to be getting younger as Quentin got older. He needed Quentin more, and he resented Quentin for that. He hated to be left out of anything, and he hated to be included in anything. He spent more time than he should have on the roof of his apartment building, smoking his merits and God knows what else. There wasn't much you couldn't find if you had the money, and they had the money. He was getting too thin. He was depressed and turned nasty when Quentin tried to jolly him out of it. When annoyed, he was fond of saying, "God, it's amazing I'm not a dipsomaniac," and then correcting himself, "Oh, wait, that's right." It had been funny the first time. Sort of. At Brakebill's, Elliot had started drinking at dinner time, earlier on weekends, which was fine, because all the upperclassmen drank at dinner, though not all of them bartered their desserts for extra glasses of wine the way Elliot did. In Manhattan, with no professors watching over them and no classes to be sober for, Elliot was rarely without a glass of something in his hand from 1 in the afternoon on. Usually it was something relatively innocuous, white wine or Campari, or a big, dilute tumbler of bourbon and soda clunking with ice. But still. Once, when Elliot was nursing a stubborn cold, Quentin remarked lightly that maybe he should consider something more wholesome than a vodka tonic with which to chase his plastic jigger of Dayquil. "I'm sick, I'm not dead," Elliot snapped. And that was that. At least one of Elliot's talents had survived graduation. He was still a tireless seeker out of obscure and wonderful bottles of wine. He was not yet such a lush that he'd abandoned his snobbishness. He went to tastings and chatted up importers and wine store owners with a zeal that he mustered for nothing else. Once every few weeks, when he had accumulated a dozen or so bottles of which he was especially proud, Elliot would announce that they were having a dinner party. It was one such dinner party that he and Quentin were preparing for today. They lavished a ridiculous amount of effort on these parties, all out of proportion to any actual fun they might get in return. The venue was always Elliot and Janet's Soho apartment, a vast pre-war warren with an implausible profusion of bedrooms, a set ripe for a French farce. Josh was head chef, with Quentin assisting as apprentice chef and kitchen runner. Elliot acted as sommelier, of course. Alice's contribution was to stop reading long enough to eat. Janet dressed the set. She formulated the night's dress code, chose the music, and hand-wrote and illustrated amazingly beautiful one-off menus. She also confabulated various surreal and sometimes controversial centerpieces. The theme of tonight's party was miscegenation, and Janet had promised, over objections, aesthetic, moral, and ornithological, to deliver Leda and the Swan staged as a pair of magically animated ice sculptures. They would copulate until they melted. As with all such evenings, the cleverness of the conceit became annoying somewhere around the middle of the afternoon before the party actually started. Quentin had found a grass skirt at an antique store, which he planned to pair with a tuxedo shirt and jacket, but the skirt was so scratchy that he gave up on it. He couldn't think of another idea, so he spent the rest of the afternoon brooding and dodging Josh, who had spent the past week researching recipes that included violently disparate ingredients wedded together. Sweet and savory, black and white, frozen and molten, eastern and western, and was now frantically slamming oven and cabinet doors and making him taste things and sniping at him over the pastry island. Alice arrived at 5:30, and Quentin and Josh both dodged her as well. By the time the party started, everybody was drunk and starving and irritable. But then, as sometimes happens with dinner parties, everything became mysteriously, spontaneously perfect again. The fabric knitted itself back together. The day before, Josh, who by this time had shaved off his beard, "It's like taking care of a damn pet," announced that he was bringing a date, which put added pressure on everybody to get their shit together. As the sun set over the Hudson, and sunbeams tinted a delicate rose by their passage through the atmosphere over New Jersey, lanced through the apartment's huge common room, and Elliot handed around Lillet cocktails, Lillet and champagne layered over a velvet hammer of vodka, in chilled martini glasses, and Quentin served miniature sweet-and-sour lobster rolls, everybody suddenly seemed, or maybe they actually were, wise and funny and good-looking. Josh had refused to reveal the identity of his date in advance, so when the elevator doors opened, they had the entire floor, Quentin had no idea that he would recognize her. It was the girl from Luxembourg, the curly-haired captain of the European team that had administered the death blow to his welter's career. It turned out, they told the story collaboratively, a set piece they'd evidently been working on, that Josh had bumped into her in a subway station where she was trying to bewitch a vending machine into adding money to her Metro card. Her name was Anaïs, and she wore a pair of snakeskin pants so ravishing that nobody asked her what, if anything, they had to do with the theme. She had blonde ringlets and a tiny, pointy nose, and Josh was obviously besotted with her. So was Quentin. He felt a wild pang of jealousy. He barely talked to Alice all night anyway, what with ducking in and out of the kitchen, warming and plating and serving things. By the time he emerged with the entrees, pork chops dusted with bitter chocolate, it was dark, and Richard was making a speech about magical theory. The wine and the food and the music and the candles were almost enough to make what he was saying seem interesting. Richard, of course, was the mysterious stranger who turned up with the other former physical kids on graduation day. He was a one-time physical kid, too, of the generation that preceded Elliot and Josh and Janet, and of them all, he was the only one who had actually entered the world of respectable professional wizardry. Richard was tall, with a big head, dark hair, square shoulders, and a big, square chin, and he was handsome in a Frankensteinian way. He was friendly enough to Quentin, firm handshake, lots of eye contact with his big, dark eyes. In conversation, he liked to address Quentin directly as Quentin a lot, which made him feel kind of like they were having a job interview. Richard was employed by the trust that managed the collective financial assets of the magical community, which were vast. He was, in a quiet way, an observant Christian. They were rare among magicians. Quentin tried to like Richard, since everybody else did, and it would just be simpler. But he was so damn earnest. He wasn't stupid, but he completely lacked any sense of humor. Jokes derailed him, so that the whole conversation had to stop while somebody, usually Janet, explained what everybody else was laughing at, and Richard knitted his thick Vulcan eyebrows in consternation at his companion's merely human foibles. And Janet, who could usually be counted on to ruthlessly flens anybody who made the mistake of taking anything seriously, Janet waited on Richard hand and foot. It annoyed Quentin to think that she might look up to Richard the same way He had once looked up to the older, physical kids. He had the definite sense that Janet must have slept with Richard once or twice back at Brakebill's. It was entirely possible that they slept together once in a while now. "Magic," Richard announced slowly, flushed, "is the tools of the maker." He almost never drank, and two glasses of Viognier had put him well over his limit. He looked first left and then right to make sure the whole table was listening. What a fatuous ass. "There's no other way of looking at it. We are dealing with a scenario where there is a person who built the house, and then he left." He rapped the table with one hand to celebrate this triumph of reason. "And when he left his tools lying around in the garage. Then we found them, and we picked them up, and we started making guesses about how they work. Now we're learning to use them, and that's magic." "There are so many things wrong with that that I don't even know where to start," Quentin distinctly heard himself say.
"So, start."
Quentin put down the food he was carrying. He had no idea what he was about to say, but he was happy to be publicly contradicting Richard. "Okay, well, first of all, there's a huge scale problem. Nobody's building universes here. We're not even building galaxies or solar systems or planets. You need cranes and bulldozers to build a house. If there is a maker, which I frankly don't see much evidence for, that's what he had. What we've got are hand tools, Black and Decker. I don't see how you get from there to what you're talking about."
"If it's a question of scale," Richard said, "I don't see that as insurmountable. Maybe we're just not..."
He searched in his wine glass for the right metaphor.
"We're not plugging our tools into the right socket. Maybe there's a much bigger socket."
"I think if you're talking about electricity," Alice put in, "you have to talk about where energy comes from."
"That's what I should have said," Quentin thought.
Alice relished theoretical arguments as much as Richard, and she was much better at them. "Any heating spell, you're demonstrably drawing energy from one place and putting it in another. If somebody created the universe, they actually created energy from somewhere. They didn't just push it around."
"Fine, but if..."
"Plus magic just doesn't feel like a tool," Alice went on. "Can you imagine how boring it would be if casting a spell were like turning on an electric drill? But it's not. It's irregular and beautiful. It's not an artifact. It's something else, something organic. It feels like a grown thing, not a made thing." She looked radiant in a silky black sheath that she knew he liked. Where had she been all night? He seemed to keep forgetting what a treasure she was.
"I bet it's alien tech," Josh said, "or fourth dimensional, like weather or something, from a direction we can't even see. Or we're in some kind of really high-tech multiplayer video game." He snapped his fingers. "So that's why Elliot's always humping my corpse."
"Not necessarily," Richard finally broke in. He was still processing Alice's argument.
"It's not necessarily irregular, or I would argue that it partakes of a higher regularity, a higher order that we haven't been allowed to see."
"Yeah, that's the answer." Elliot was visibly drunk.
"That's the answer to everything. God save us from Christian magicians. You sound just like my parents. That is just exactly what my ignorant Christian parents would say. Just if it doesn't fit with your theory, well, that's just because, oh, it actually does. But God is mysterious, so we can't see it because we're so sinful. That's so fucking easy."
He fished around in the remnants of Janet's centerpiece with a long serving fork. Lida and the swan were indistinguishable from each other now, two rounded Brancusi forms still gamely humping away as a tide of slush
rose up to drown them.
"Well, heck, we ought to call ourselves the Metaphysical Kids," Josh said.
"And who the fuck is this Maker you're talking about?" Elliot snarled. He was getting vehement and not listening. "Are you talking about God? Because if you're talking about God, just say God."
"All right," Richard said placidly. "Let's say God."
"Is this a moral God? Is he going to punish us for using his holy magic, for being bad little magicians? Is he..."
"She," Janet shouted, "going to come back and give us a good spanking because we got into the garage and played with Daddy's power tools?"
"Because that is just stupid. It's just stupid and it's ignorant. No one gets punished for anything. We do whatever we want, and that's all we do, and nobody stops us, and nobody cares."
"If he left us his tools, he left them for a reason," Richard said.
"And I suppose you know what that is." "What's the next wine, Elliot?"
Janet asked brightly. She always kept a cool head in difficult moments, maybe because she tended to be so out of control so much of the rest of the time. She looked unusually ravishing tonight, too, in a slinky red tunic that made it to her mid-thigh, barely, before it gave out. The kind of thing Alice would never wear. Couldn't, not with her figure. Both Richard and Elliot seemed to want to extend the fight by another round, but Elliot, with an effort of will, allowed himself to be diverted.
"An excellent question," Elliot pressed his hands to his temples. "I am receiving a divine vision from the Almighty Maker of an exquisitely expensive small-batch bourbon which God, or, I'm sorry, the Makeress, has commanded me to render unto you forthwith."
He stood up unsteadily and lurched in the direction of the kitchen. Quentin found him sitting red-faced and sweating on a stool by an open window. Icy air was pouring in, but Elliot didn't seem to notice. He stared out unblinking at the city, which receded in perspectival lines of lights fanning out into the blackness. He said nothing. He didn't move as Quentin helped Richard manage the individual baked Alaskas, the trick, Richard explained in his well-practiced explaining tone, was to make sure the meringue, an excellent heat insulator, formed a complete seal over the ice cream core. And Quentin wondered if they'd lost Elliot for the evening. It wouldn't be the first time he drank himself out of contention. But a few minutes later, he rallied and trailed them back into the dining room with a slender, oddly shaped bottle sloshing with amber-colored whiskey. Things were winding down. Everyone was treading carefully so as not to trigger another outburst from Elliot or another sermon from Richard. Not long afterward, Josh left to take Anais home, and Richard retired of his own accord, leaving Quentin, Janet, and Elliot to preside woozily over the empty bottles and crumpled napkins. One of the candles had charred a hole in the tablecloth.
Where was Alice? Had she gone home? Or crashed in one of the spare rooms? He tried her cell. No answer.
Elliot had dragged a pair of ottomans over to the table. He reclined on them Roman style, though they were too low, so he had to reach up to get his drink, and all Quentin could see of him was his groping hand. Janet lay down too, spooned up contentedly behind him.
"Coffee?" she asked.
"Cheese," Elliot said.
"Do we have cheese? I need cheese."
On cue, Peggy Lee wandered through the opening verse of "Is That All There Is?" on the stereo. Which would be worse, Quentin wondered. If Richard was right and there was an angry, moral God, or if Elliot was right and there was no point at all. If magic was created for a purpose, or if they could do whatever they wanted with it. Something like a panic attack came over him. They were really in trouble out here. There was nothing to hang on to. They couldn't go on like this forever. "There's a Morbière in the kitchen," he said. "It was supposed to go with the theme. You know, the two layers, the morning milking, the night milking.
Yeah, yeah, we get it, Janet said.
Fetch, Q. Go on.
I'll go, Elliot said. But instead of standing up, he just rolled weakly off the couch and fell on the floor. His head made an ominously loud bonk as it hit the parquet. But he was laughing as Quentin and Janet picked him up, Quentin getting his shoulders and Janet taking his feet, all thoughts of cheese extinguished, and maneuvered him out of the dining room and in the direction of his bedroom. On their way out the door, Elliot's head hit the door frame with another loud bonk, and then it was just too absolutely hilarious, and they all started laughing. And they laughed until they were completely useless, and Janet dropped his feet, and Quentin dropped his shoulders, and his head bonked on the floor again, and by this time it was 1,000 times more funny than the first 2 times. It took Quentin and Janet 20 minutes to get Elliot down the hall to his bedroom, lurching heavily against the walls with their arms around each other, as if they were struggling down a flooded steerage-level corridor on the Titanic. The world had become smaller and somehow lighter. Nothing meant anything. But what was meaning anyway but a burden that weighed them down? Elliot kept saying he was fine, and Quentin and Janet kept insisting they had to pick him up. Janet announced that she had peed herself, actually literally peed herself, she was laughing so hard. As they passed Richard's door, Elliot began a loud speech on the order of, "I am the mighty maker, and I now bequeath to you my holy power tools, because I am too fucking drunk to use them anymore, and good luck to you, because when I get up tomorrow they had better be exactly where I left them, exactly, even my... no, especially my belt sander, because I'm going to be so fucking hungover tomorrow. Anybody who fucks with my belt sander is going to get a taste of my belt, and it won't taste good at all." Finally, they heaved him onto his bed and tried to make him drink water and pulled up the covers over his chest. It could have been the sheer domesticity of it. It was as if Elliot were their beloved son whom they were lovingly tucking in for the night. Or maybe it was just boredom, that powerful aphrodisiac, which had never been entirely out of sight, even during the party's best moments. But if he was honest with himself, Quentin had known for at least 20 minutes, even as they were wrestling Elliot down the hall, that he was going to take Janet's dress off as soon as he had half a chance. Quentin woke up slowly the next morning. So slowly, over such a long time, that he was never really sure he'd been asleep at all. The bed felt unstable and disconcertingly floaty, and it was weird with 2 other naked people there. They kept bumping into each other and inadvertently touching and pulling away, and then feeling self-conscious about having pulled away. At first, in the first flush of it, he felt no regret about what happened. It was what you were supposed to do. He was living life to the fullest, getting drunk and giving in to forbidden passions. That was the stuff of life. Wasn't that the lesson of the foxes? If Alice had any blood in her veins, she would have joined them. But no, she had to go to bed early. She was just like Richard. Well, welcome to life in the grown-up magical world, Alice. Magic wasn't going to solve everything. Couldn't she see that? Couldn't she see that they were all dying? That everything was futile? That the only thing to do was to live and drink and fuck whatever and whomever while you still could? She herself had warned him of that, right there in her parents' house in Illinois. And she'd been right. And then after a while it seemed like a debatable thing. You could really make the case both ways. It was a coin flip. And then it was an unfortunate lapse, an indiscretion, still within the bounds of the forgivable, but definitely a low point, not a personal best. And then it was a major indiscretion, a bad mistake. And then, in the last act of the striptease, it revealed itself to be what it truly was, a terrible, really awful, hurtful
betrayal.
At some point during this slow, incremental fall from grace, Quentin became aware of Alice sitting at the foot of the bed, just her back, facing away from where he and Janet and Elliot lay, resting her chin in her hands. Periodically he imagined that it was just a dream, that she hadn't been there at all. But to be honest, he was pretty sure she had. She hadn't looked like a figment. She had been fully dressed. She must have been up for a while. Around 9 o'clock, the room was full of morning light, and Quentin couldn't pretend to be asleep anymore. He sat up. He wasn't wearing a shirt, and he couldn't remember where his shirt was. He wasn't wearing anything else, either. He would have given anything right then just to have a shirt and some underwear. With his bare feet on the hardwood floor, he felt strangely insubstantial. He couldn't understand, couldn't quite believe what he'd done. It just didn't seem like him. Maybe Fogg was right. Maybe magic had inhibited his moral development. Something must have. Maybe that was why he was such a shit. But there had to be a way he could make Alice understand how sorry he was. He dragged a blanket off Elliot's bed. Janet stirred and complained sleepily, then went back to her dreamless, guiltless sleep, and wrapped it around himself and padded out into the silent apartment. The dinner table was like a shipwreck. The kitchen looked like a crime scene. Their little planet was ruined, and there was nowhere left for him to stand. Quentin thought about Professor Mayakovsky, how he'd reversed time, fixed the glass globe, brought the spider back to life. That would be a pretty nice thing to be able to do right about now. When the elevator doors pinged open, Quentin thought it must be Josh coming back from a successful night with Anaïs. Instead, it was Penny, pale and breathing hard from running, and so excited he could barely contain himself. Penny's story. He had a new mohawk, a proud iridescent green ruff 1 inch wide and 3 inches high, like the crest of a centurion's helmet. He had also gained weight. He looked, oddly, younger and softer than he had at Brakebill's, less like a lone Iroquois warrior, and more like an overfed white suburban gangsta. But it was still Penny who was catching his breath on the oriental rug and looking around at everything like a curious, judgmental rabbit. He wore a black leather jacket with chrome spikes on it, faded black jeans, and a grubby white T-shirt. Jesus, Quentin thought. Do they even have punks anymore? He must be the last one in New York. Penny sniffed and wiped his nose on his sleeve. Neither of them spoke. Quentin knew enough to know that Penny would never stoop to petty social pleasantries like saying hello and asking how he'd been and explaining what the hell he was doing here. Just this once, Quentin was grateful. He didn't know if he could face it. "How'd you get in here?" Quentin croaked. His mouth was parched. "Your doorman was asleep. You should really fire him." "It's not my doorman." He cleared his throat laboriously. "You must have cast something." "Just Chumley stealth." Penny gave it the correct English pronunciation. "Chumley's." "Elliot has a ward on this whole floor. I helped him set it up. Plus you need a key for the elevator." "We'll need to set a new ward. I unpicked it on the way up." "Fucking..." "Okay, first, who's we? We who?" Quentin said. At this moment, his dearest wish would have been just a moment's grace to immerse his face in a sink full of warm water, and maybe to have somebody hold him under till he drowned. "And second, Penny, Jesus, it took us a whole weekend to put up that ward." He did a quick check. Penny was right. The defensive spells around the apartment were gone, so gone that they hadn't even alerted him when they were going. Quentin couldn't quite believe it. Penny must have taken down their ward from the outside, on the fly, from a standing start, in no more time than it took him to ride up 10 floors in an elevator. Quentin kept his face blank. He didn't want to give Penny the satisfaction of seeing how impressed he was.
What about the key?
Penny dug it out of his jacket pocket and tossed it to Quentin.
Took it off your doorman, he shrugged. Kind of thing you learn on the street.
Quentin was going to say something about how the street in question was probably not a street at all, but a way or a lane located in some gated community, and anyway, it wasn't that hard to steal a key from a sleeping doorman when you were rocking Chumley's stealth. But it just seemed so unimportant, and the words were just too heavy to get out of his mouth, like they were stone blocks in his stomach that he would have had to physically cough up and regurgitate. Fuck Penny, he was wasting time. He had to talk to Alice.
But by then, people had heard Penny's voice. Richard came shambling in from the kitchen where he'd been cleaning up, already awake and irritatingly showered and coiffed and groomed and pressed.
Soon Janet came out of Elliot's room, regally swathed in a comforter as if nothing whatsoever unusual had happened the night before. She squeaked when she saw Penny and disappeared into a bathroom. Quentin realized he would have to get dressed and deal with this. Daylight was here, and with it had come the world of appearances and lies and acting like everything was fine. They were all going to make scrambled eggs and talk about how hungover they were and drink mimosas and Bloody Marys with extra Tabasco and black pepper, and act like nothing was wrong, as if Quentin hadn't just broken Alice's heart for no better reason than that he was drunk and felt like it. And as unbelievable, as unthinkable as it seemed, they were going to listen to what Penny had to say. He was a year behind Quentin and Alice, but by the end of his fourth year, Penny had decided, he explained, once his audience was assembled and dressed and arranged around him in the living room with drinks and plates, standing or lying full length on couches or sitting cross-legged on the floor as their physical and emotional conditions permitted, that Breakbills had taught him everything it was going to teach him. So he dropped out and moved to a small town in Maine, a few miles north of Bar Harbor. The town was called Oslo, a seedy little resort village with a population that shrank by 80% in the off-season. Penny chose Oslo, not even New Oslo, just Oslo, as if they thought they came up with it first, for its total lack of anything that might distract him. He arrived in mid-September and had no trouble renting a small farmhouse on the outskirts of town on a one-lane rural route. His landlord was a retired schoolteacher who handed him the keys and then fled to his winter home in South Carolina. Penny's nearest neighbors on either side were a congregationless one-shack Pentecostal church and an out-of-session summer camp for disturbed children. It was perfect. He had found his Walden. He had everything he needed, silence, solitude, a U-Haul trailer packed with an enviable library of magical codices, monographs, chapbooks, reference books, and broadsheets. He had a sturdy desk, a well-lit room, and a window with an unscenic view of an unmown backyard that offered no particular temptation to gaze out at it. He had a manageable, intriguingly dangerous research project that showed every sign of maturing into a genuinely interesting line of inquiry. He was in heaven. But one afternoon, a few weeks after he arrived, as he sat at his desk, his watery blue eyes trailing over words of consummate power written centuries ago with a pen made out of a hippogriff feather, Penny found his mind wandering. His large, usually lineless brow crinkled. Something was sapping his powers of concentration. Was he under attack, maybe by a rival researcher? Who would dare? He rubbed his eyes and shook his head and focused harder. But his attention continued to drift. It turned out that Penny had discovered in himself a weakness, a flaw, he never would have suspected himself of in 1,000 years, an age to which, with a few careful modifications that he would look into when he had the time, he had every intention of living. The flaw was this. He was lonely.
The idea was outrageous. It was humiliating. He, Penny, was a stone-cold loner, a desperado. He was the Han Solo of Oslo. He knew and loved this about himself. He had spent 4 interminable years at Brakebill's surrounded by idiots, except for Melanie, as he privately referred to Professor van der Veer. And now he was finally free of their incessant bullshit. But now Penny found himself doing things for no reason. Unproductive things. He stood on a concrete dam near his farmhouse and threw down rocks to break up the thin crust of ice that formed on the outflow pond. He walked the 1.5 miles to the center of town and played video games in the windowless video arcade back behind the pharmacy, stuffing his mouth with stale gumballs from the gumball machine, alongside the no-hope, dead-eyed teenagers who hung out there and did the exact same thing. He made awkward, inexperienced eyes at the underage clerk at the book bin, which actually sold mostly stationery and greeting cards, not books. He confided his troubles to the miserable pod of 4 buffalo who lived on the buffalo farm out on the Bar Harbor Road. He thought about climbing over the fence and petting one of their huge, wedge-shaped heads, but he didn't quite have the nerve. They were big buffalo, and you never knew what they were thinking. That was September. By October, he had bought an herb-green Subaru Impreza and was making regular trips to a dance club in Bangor, swigging from a 1/5 of vodka on the passenger seat, since the club was all ages and didn't serve alcohol, as he drove the 45 minutes through trackless pine forests. Progress on his research project had dwindled to almost nothing, a couple of hours a day of listless leafing through old notes punctuated by generous breaks for online porn. It was humiliating. The dance club in Bangor was open only on Friday and Saturday nights, and all he did there was shoot pool in a half-lit lounge area off the main dance floor with other creepy male loners like himself. But it was in that half-lit lounge on one of those Saturday nights that he spotted, to his secret consternation and even more secret relief and gratitude, a familiar face. It was a hard face to like, the face of an emaciated corpse that hadn't been particularly attractive even in life, with a horrible pencil mustache on its upper lip. It belonged to the itinerant salesman, Lovelady. Lovelady was in the dance club in Bangor for approximately the same reason that Penny was there. He had run as far away as he could from the world of breakbills and magic, and then gotten lonely. Over a pitcher of Coors Light and a few games of pool, all of which Lovelady won handily — you don't spend a lifetime trafficking in fake magical items without picking up a few real skills — they exchanged stories. Lovelady depended heavily for his livelihood on luck and the gullibility of strangers. He spent most of his time trolling the world's junk shops and estate sales the way long-line fishermen troll the ocean. He accosted the emotionally vulnerable widows of recently deceased magicians and loitered on the outskirts of the conversations of his wisers and betters, keeping his eye out for anything that had value or that might plausibly be made to appear to have value. He had spent the past few months in northern England, in a studio apartment over a garage in a dreary suburb of Hull, trying his luck in antique stores and second-hand bookshops. His days were spent on buses, and when he was really down on his luck, on an ancient one-speed bicycle he borrowed without permission from the garage, which he wasn't supposed to have access to. At some point during his stay, Lovelady began to receive unwanted attention. Normally he was desperate for anybody to pay attention to him, anybody at all. But this was very different. Strangers on buses stared fixedly at him for no reason. Payphones rang when he walked by them. When he counted his change, he found only coins from the year he was born. When he watched TV, all he saw was an image of his own face, with a mysterious, empty city in the background. Lovelady was neither learned nor particularly intelligent, but
But he survived on his instincts, and all his instincts told him that something was gravely amiss. Alone in his apartment, sitting on his pea-soup-colored foam couch, Lovelady took stock. His best guess was this. He had inadvertently acquired an object of genuine power, and something out there coveted it. He was being hunted. That same night, he pulled up stakes. He abandoned his security deposit, donned a rattling array of charms and fetishes, took a bus to London and the Channel train to Paris, and from there crossed the Atlantic to throw himself on the already overtaxed mercy of breakbills. He spent an exhausting afternoon combing the woods north of New York for the school's familiar, comforting compound. As the sun set through the trees and the early winter chill gnawed at the tips of his ears, the horrifying truth sank in. He was in the right place, but breakbills would no longer appear to him. Something, either him or his wares, was objectionable to the school's defensive spells. Whatever he was carrying had rendered him untouchable. That was when he cut and ran to Maine. It was ironic, for once in his life, Lovelady had lucked into something genuinely powerful, a big score. But it was too much luck all at once. He was out of his league. He could have dumped his stock, all of it, right there in the middle of the frozen woods, but after a lifetime of greedy scrimping, he didn't quite have the gumption. It would have broken his avaricious heart. Instead, he rented a cozy cabin in the woods at the off-season rate and conducted a thorough inventory. He recognized it right away, mixed in with a jumbled consignment of grubby costume jewelry in a plastic bag tied with a twisty. He didn't know what it was, but its power was obvious, even to his untrained eye. He motioned Penny over to a corner, reached into the pocket of his seedy overcoat, which he hadn't taken off all night, and laid the baggie on a round particleboard bar table. He grinned his livid, discolored grin at Penny. The buttons were ordinary surplus vintage buttons. Two holes, four holes, fake leather, fake tortoise shell, big angular novelty knobs, and tiny bakelite pinpricks. A few of them were just leftover beads. Penny's eye immediately went to one of them, a flat, otherwise unremarkable, pearlescent white overcoat button about an inch across. It was heavier than it should have been. It practically vibrated with barely contained magical force. He knew what it was. He knew better than to touch it. "A magic button?" Janet said. "How weird. What was it?" Her hair was a disaster, but she was obscenely relaxed, sipping coffee in an armchair, showing off her legs in a short silk bathrobe. She obviously felt triumphant, relishing her conquest, and by extension her victory over Alice. Quentin hated her at that moment. "You really don't know?" Penny said. Quentin thought he had a guess, but he wasn't going to say it out loud. "What did you do?" he said instead.
"I made him come back with me to my house that night. He wasn't safe where he was, and at least I had a basic security set up. We called the woman who sold him the consignment, but she insisted the buttons weren't in her records. The next day we went and got his stuff and drove to Boston, and I gave him $80,000 for it. He wouldn't take cash, just gold and diamonds. I practically cleaned out a Harry Winston, but it was worth it. Then I told him to fuck off, and he did."
$80,000, Elliot said, "wouldn't clear out a display case at a Zales, let alone a Harry Winston." Penny ignored him.
"That was 2 days ago. That button attracts attention. I was staying at a hotel in Boston, but last night a fire two floors above me killed a cleaning lady. I never went back to my room. I took the Feng Hua bus from South Station. I had to walk here from Chinatown. Whenever I got in a cab, the engine would die. But what matters is that it's real, and it's ours."
Ours?
Who are we? Richard asked.
You, Quentin said coldly, are a fucking nut job.
Quentin gets it, Penny said. Anybody else? Q, what is he talking about?
A silent spear of pure, glittering ice entered Quentin's heart. He hadn't heard Alice come in. She stood at the edge of the circle, her hair unwashed and adrift, like a sleepy child who wakes in the middle of the night and appears like an uncertain spirit at the edge of a grown-up party.
He doesn't know what he's talking about, Quentin muttered. He couldn't look at her. He was drowning in remorse. It almost made him angry at her, how much it hurt to look at her.
Do you want to explain it, or should I? Penny said.
You do it. I'm not going to be able to say it without laughing my head off.
Well, somebody say something, or I'm going back to bed, Elliot said.
Ladies and gentlemen, Penny said, gravely and grandly, we are all going to Fillory. At the end of The Wandering Dune, Penny began. It was a lecture he had obviously rehearsed. Helen and Jane Chatwin receive a gift from Highbound, the captain of the rabbit-crewed clipper ship that the girls encounter in the desert. The gift is a little brass-bound oak chest containing 5 magical buttons, all different shapes and colors, one for each of the Chatwins, each with the power to take the wearer from Earth to Fillory and back again at will. Everybody in the room had read the Fillory books, in Quentin's case multiple times, but Penny rehearsed the rules anyway. The buttons don't take you directly there. First, they move you to a kind of in-between netherworld, an interdimensional layover, and from there you can make the leap to Fillory. No one knows where this transitional world is. It may be an alternate plane of existence, or a place between planes, interleaved between them like a flower pressed between pages, or a master plane that contains all planes, the spine that gathers the pages and binds them together. To the naked eye, it looks like a deserted city, an endless series of empty stone squares, but it serves as a kind of multidimensional switchboard. In the center of each square is a fountain. Step into one of them, the story goes, and you'll be transported to another universe. There are hundreds of different squares, possibly an infinite number, and a corresponding number of alternate universes. The bunnies call this place the Neitherlands, because it's neither here nor there, or sometimes just the city. But the most important point, Penny said, is that at the end of The Wandering Dune, Helen hid all the buttons somewhere in her aunt's house in Cornwall. She felt they were too mechanical. They made the journey too easy. Their power was wrong. You shouldn't be able to just go to Fillory whenever you wanted, like catching a bus, she argued. A trip to Fillory had to be earned. That had always been the way. It was a reward for the worthy bestowed by the ram gods Ember and Umber. The buttons were a perversion of this divine grace, a usurping of it. They broke the rules. Ember and Umber couldn't control them. Fillory was fundamentally a religious fantasy, but the buttons weren't religious at all. They were magical. They were just tools with no values attached. You could use them for anything you wanted, good or evil. They were so magical they were practically technological. So she hid them. Jane was inconsolable, understandably enough, and tore up half the property looking for them. But according to The Wandering Dune, she never found them, and Plover never wrote any more books. The Wandering Dune ends in the summer of 1917, or possibly 1918. Because of the lack of real-world detail, it's impossible to date it precisely. After that, the whereabouts of the buttons is unknown. But try a thought experiment, Penny suggested. How long could a box of buttons hidden by a 12-year-old girl plausibly have stayed hidden? 10 years? 50? Nothing stays hidden forever. Wasn't it possible, even inevitable,
that in the decades that followed, a maid or a real estate agent or another little girl would have found them again, and that from there they would have made their way onto the magical gray market?
I always thought they were supposed to be lapel buttons, Richard said, like a pin, like I like Ike.
Okay, so let's back up for a second, Quentin said cheerily. He was in the perfect mood for somebody, anybody besides himself, to make an ass of himself. And if that person could be Penny, and if Quentin could help him do it, then ever so much the better.
The Fillory books are fiction? Nothing you're talking about actually happened?
Yes and no, Penny said, surprisingly reasonably. I'll allow that much of Plover's narrative might be fictional or fictionalized, but I've come to believe that the basic mechanics of interdimensional travel that Plover describes are quite real.
Really? Quentin knew Penny well enough to know that he never bluffed, but he kept going anyway out of pig-headedness, urged on by his own inner vileness.
And what makes you think that?
Penny regarded him with benevolent pity as he prepared the hammer blow.
Well, I can certainly tell you that the Nitherlands are very real. I've spent most of the past 3 years there.
No one had an answer to this. The room was silent. Quentin finally dared to glance over at Alice, but her face was a mask. It would almost have been better if she looked angry.
I don't know if you know this, Penny said. In fact, I'm pretty sure you don't, but I did most of my work at Breakbills on travel between alternate worlds, or between planes, as we called them, Melanie and I. As far as we could determine, it was an entirely new discipline. Not that I was the first person ever to study the subject, but I was the first to have a special aptitude for it. My talents were so unusual that Melanie, Professor Vandeveya, decided to pull me out of regular classes and give me my own course of study. The spellcraft was extremely involved, and I had to improvise a lot of it. I can tell you, a lot of what's in the canon on this stuff is way off base. Way off base. They're not seeing the whole picture, and the part of it they are seeing is by far the least important part. You'd think your friend Bigby would have some grasp of this stuff, but he has no idea. I was surprised. I really was. But there were still some issues I couldn't resolve.
Such as? Elliot said.
Well, so far, I've only been able to travel alone. I can transport my body and clothes and some small supplies, but nothing else and nobody else. Second, I can cross to the Nitherlands, but that's it. I'm stuck there. The wider multiverse is closed to me.
You mean, said Janet.
Wait, so you've been to this amazing, magical interville, but that's it?
She actually looked underwhelmed.
I thought you were coming in here this badass multidimensional desperado and all.
No.
Penny could be defensive when he felt like he was under attack, but he was so autistically focused right now that even direct mockery bounced right off him.
My explorations have been limited to the city. It's quite a rich environment in itself, an amazingly complex artifact to a magically trained eye. There's so little information in the books. The wandering dune is told through the eyes of a child, and it's not clear to me that either Plover or the Chatwins had any particular command of the techniques they describe. I thought at first that the entire place was a kludge, a virtual environment that functioned as a kind of three-dimensional interface hacked onto a master interdimensional switchboard. Not that it's much of an interface. A maze of identical, unlabeled squares? How much help is that? But it was all I could think of. The thing is, the more I study it, the more I think it's exactly the opposite, that our world has much less substance than the city, and what we experience as reality is really just a footnote to what goes on there, an epiphenomenon. But now that we have the button,
he patted his jeans pocket,
we'll learn so much more. We'll go so much further.
Have you tried it? Richard asked.
Penny hesitated. For somebody who so obviously wanted to be hardcore, he was painfully transparent.
Of course he hasn't, Quentin said, smelling blood. He's scared shitless. He has no idea what that thing is, only that it's dangerous as hell, and he wants one of us to be a guinea pig.
That's absolutely not true, Penny said. His ears were getting red. An artifact on this level is best faced in the company of allies and observers, with the proper controls and safeguards. No reasonable magician.
Look, Penny. Now Quentin could play the reasonable one, and he did it with maximum nastiness. Slow down. You've gotten so far ahead of yourself, you can't even see how you got there. You've seen an old city and a bunch of pools and fountains, and you've got a button with some heavy-duty enchantments on it, and you're looking for some framework to fit them all together, and you've latched onto this fillery thing. But you're grasping at straws. It's crazy. You're cramming a few chance data points into a story that has nothing to do with reality. You need to take a giant step back. Take a deep breath. You're way off the reservation.
Nobody spoke. The skepticism in the room was palpable. Quentin was winning, and he knew it. Penny looked around at his audience beseechingly, unable to believe that he was losing them. Alice stepped forward into the empty circle around Penny.
Quentin, she said, you have always been the most unbelievable pussy.
Her voice broke only a little as she said it. She grabbed Quentin's wrist with one hand and shoved the other one into the left-hand pocket of Penny's baggy black jeans. She fumbled for an instant. Then they vanished together. The Netherlands. Quentin was swimming, or he could have been swimming, but in fact he was just floating. It was dark, and his body was weightless, suspended in chilly water. His testicles shrank in on themselves away from the cold. Wavering, heatless sunbeams lanced down through the darkness. After the first shock, the coolness of the water, combined with the weightlessness, felt indescribably good to his dried-out, feverish, unshowered, hungover body. He could have thrashed and panicked, but instead he just let himself hang there, arms out in a dead man's float. Whatever was coming next would come. He opened his eyes, and the water bathed them in moist, healing chill. He closed them again. There was nothing to see. It was a glorious relief. The numbness of it was just magnificent. At the moment when it had been at its most intolerably painful, the world, normally so unreliable and insensitive in these matters, had done him the favor of vanishing completely. Granted, he would need air at some point. He would look into that in due course. As bad as things were, drowning would still be a hasty course of action. For now, all he wanted was to stay here forever, hanging neutrally buoyant in the amniotic void, neither in the world nor out of it, neither dead nor alive. But an iron manacle was clamped around his wrist. It was Alice's hand, and it was pulling him upward, ruthlessly. She wouldn't let him be. Reluctantly, he joined her in kicking toward the surface. Their heads broke water at the same moment. They were in the center of a still, hushed, empty city square, treading water in the round pool of a fountain. It was absolutely silent. No wind, no birds, no insects. Broad paving stones stretched away in all directions, clean and bare as if they'd just been swept. On all four sides of the square stood a row of stone buildings. They gave off an impression of indescribable age. They weren't decrepit, but they'd been lived in. They looked vaguely Italianate. They could have been in Rome or Venice.
but they weren't. The sky was low and overcast, and a light rain was falling, almost mist. The droplets